Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
I'd like to start our account of the 1980s, not as is usually done with President Ronald Reagan, because in fact President Reagan didn't come to office until the beginning of 1981 and wasn't elected till close to the end of 1980. So in some respects, it's rather a mistake to begin with Ronald Reagan. Instead, as far as the West is concerned, I think it's pertinent to begin at the beginning of the decade. And that would be the State of the Union Address to Congress in January 1980, given, of course, by President Jimmy Carter, who warned, quote, that the Afghan invasion, by which he meant the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, could pose the most serious threat to peace since the Second World War. Now, I mean, that was clearly an exaggeration of the country's significance, both the significance of Afghanistan to American policymakers, and indeed, nobody was to know in 1980 that American troops would be in Afghanistan from 2001. That would have surprised people, which is something worth thinking about and noting. But it was actually an exaggeration as far as the situation was in 1980. The Soviet operation can be seen in different lights, but it's probably best to regard it as a policing operation, frontier policing and consolidation operation, in what was a secondary zone. I've already indicated that the bulk of the Soviet army, including its key units, remained positioned to invade Western Europe. And insofar as the Soviet Union was looking at what one might describe as Asian spheres of conflict or opportunity, Afghanistan was secondary to whatever might come out of the crisis caused by the overthrow of the Shah in Iran and subsequently by the outbreak in 1980 of the Iran-Iraq War. There was the question of what might be done to unravel President Carter's solution to the Israeli-Egyptian issues. And on top of that, there were the poor relations between the Soviet Union and China. So Afghanistan was definitely secondary, except insofar as it might relate to any one of those issues. In other words, to suggest to other powers that that the Soviet Union was one that was able to undo the advantages of other powers. Nevertheless, I think it's fair to say that the invasion of Afghanistan contributed to what became very apparent in the United States in the early 80s, which was simultaneously a sense of alarm, concern, anxiety about developments in Southwest Asia, in which Iran was the key element. The Americans had lost a crucial regional ally in the Shah, an ally who in some respects was militarily more potent than, in fact, than Israel. And there was the danger, it would seem, of a spread of Islamic adventurism and Soviet power in that region. And then on top of that, there was a more general anxiety that was very much picked up by Reaganite commentators about what appeared to be Soviet adventurism. The death of Leonid Brezhnev in 1982 was followed by 3 years in which the Soviet Union appeared to be less predictable. At the very least, there weren't the connections that had been developed during the Brezhnev years, and the sense of a degree of complacency in terms of the relative stasis of the later Brezhnev period and the ideology that Brezhnev offered of a form of coexistence. So there was a sense of alarm bells going. Now, the exact order of priorities varied by commentator. Much of it focused on Europe, and in particular, the arrival of Soviet intermediate range nuclear missiles in Eastern Europe, which created a sense and a possibility that the Soviet Union would be able to launch a attack on Western Europe, knowing that, as it were, the Western powers would not resort to intercontinental ballistic missiles, because the Soviets would counter those. But in the meantime, with the Soviets having a key capability advantage at that area, at that level. Now, nobody, the intermediate level, nobody knew what would happen, but uncertainty rose and increased. And that uncertainty also looked to the degree to which détente appeared to be abandoned with the suppression of the solidarity, violent suppression of the solidarity movement in Poland, and furthermore, outside Europe, by the extent to which very left-wing nationalist movements were advancing and having greater success. Whether one was thinking about Nicaragua and the possibility that Nicaragua would serve as the base for expansionism elsewhere, whether it was Cuba looking into establishing a, as it were, a client state and certainly a client air base on Grenada, or whether it was Southern Africa, in which the fall of the white regime in Zimbabwe, in southern Rhodesia, appeared to open the possibility of a serious reverse for white majority governments in southern Africa, with Southwest Africa, South Africa itself in the front line, and with the UNITA movement in Angola under greater challenge. So in other words, there appeared to be a situation in which, if one thought of the world in terms of a zero-sum game, then the Soviet Union was doing well and the Western alliance was doing not so well. There was also, of course, other aspects to look at, but that was the one that most attracted the attention of strategists. Now, I think it's fair to say that very few people envisaged what was to happen at the end of the decade, which is the bifurcation of the Cold War, the crisis of communist power in Eastern Europe, but contemporaneously with that, the suppression of a reform movement in China. And both of those are significant in terms of the differential movement of authoritarianism. Now, in Eastern Europe, the opposite example appeared to be the case. After all, the solidarity movement, in terms of the support it enjoyed, was considerable. It appeared sustained. And yet, the Polish army proved willing to answer, as it were, Soviet demands that it act, and that gave strategic depth to the Soviet forces in Eastern Europe and seemed to both represent in practice, but also symbolize the continued solidity of the communist bloc in Eastern Europe. What was less clear were the weaknesses of this bloc. And you can look at these in very different ways, and they are obviously pertinent if we're thinking in terms of geopolitics. After all, if geopolitics is in some way a structural force, then how do we explain Mikhail Gorbachev and the way in which there was to be an abrupt change in Soviet policy, and indeed the in Soviet stability, first in Eastern Europe and then more generally in the Soviet Union. I mean, really, Gorbachev oughtn't to be there if geography is destiny, as proclaimed so glibly by authors like Tim Marshall and by other people that write on political and historical geography. Vladimir Putin, in his State of the Nation address in 2005, was to refer to the fall of the Soviet Union as the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the century. But it's a little difficult to know quite how one sees geopolitics as playing the key role in 1989, 1990, 1991, and 1992. And incidentally, the Putin approach is a rather curious one, because in terms of the number of Soviet citizens killed, one might imagine that the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the century could be dated to the Stalin years, obviously and most explicitly to the enormous damage caused by successive German offensives in 1941 and 1942, but also in a way the Soviet, and more geopolitically, the Soviet-German Pact of 1939, which enabled Hitler to fight what in effect were one-front wars, and therefore to clear the deck prior to attacking the Soviet Union. Now, what one's trying to emphasize here, I'm not a one, that sounds rather ominous and dangerous. What I'm trying to emphasize is, if you think about the Putin remark, it reflects the should-be approach to geopolitics, which I'm afraid is all too common. Geopolitics as rhetoric, geopolitics as a could or a should or a must, but not geopolitics as some sort of a analysis in which one allows for differing consequences from the same set of geographical considerations. And it's worth bearing in mind that if we are looking at geographical considerations for the 1980s, then possibly what we ought to be focusing on are whatever one means by geo-financial ones. And in particular, the extent to which the reinvestment of oil revenues in the United States ensured that petrodollars, which after all were the great product of the 1970s oil increases and the great product of the reliance on oil, petrol dollars became in practice a measure of American influence. And that, incidentally, that meant it was necessary for the United States to maintain its position in the Middle East. So in other words, you could argue that geopolitics was a consequence of the geo-financial situation. Similarly, the beneficiaries of East Asian economic growth, especially Japan, which had become the world's second largest economy, but also, for example, Taiwan, South Korea, they also invested in the United States, which helped the Americans to finance imports from East Asia. And in particular, the Americans were able to draw on both the economic growth of Japan and South Korea and Taiwan, but also through their alignment with China on the strategic asset of Chinese cooperation. So if you want to look at this in a geopolitical sense, the key element of the geopolitics of the 1980s is not faffing around in Europe with SS-20s or cruise and Patriot missiles. It's the nature of the alignment and cooperation, shared enterprise, if you like, between East Asian powers and the United States, that in short, we have a Pacific primacy and one that Europeans can close their eyes to under the misapprehension that people actually cared whether they demonstrated at Greenham Common or anything else. Moreover, under the American umbrella, there were no serious issues in dispute between China and Japan, whilst the Soviet refusal to make any concession over returning to Japan the gains made in 1945, the Kuril Islands and southern Sakhalin, helped to make sure that Japan further remained in the American bloc. So there was a geopolitical alignment in the 1980s between America and capital-rich East Asia and the Middle East. And that was encouraged by, in some respects, what was one of the more important, if you wish to use the term, geopolitical events of that decade, of the early years of that decade, not the ones that tend to be cited, which was the ending in 1984 by the Reagan government of the withholding tax on interest on income tax paid to non-residents. This encouraged large-scale foreign purchase of treasury bonds, which helped contain inflation and finance rising military expenditure. Moreover, attractive American interest rates in the 1980s kept the demand strong and ensured that global capital flows focused on the United States, which put heavy pressure on the states that had borrowed heavily in the 1970s, notably in Eastern Europe, but also in South America, which helped further to strengthen American influence and also put an enormous burden on Soviet client states in Eastern Europe. So in some respects, that was as significant, more significant, less significant, we can at least discuss than the standard military, strategic, and political agenda. Furthermore, the ability of the United States to cope with domestic discontent or division, the situation which is very apparent today, was assuaged by its ability to fund its commitments. This again was significant, whereas at the present moment, it's unclear whether an American government, whatever its political composition after the next presidential election, will be able to fund the expectations and commitments, both of American strategists and more particularly of America's allies. So that may well be the case that if we look back into the 1980s, we can see that what Reaganomics did, however limited it might appear in terms of economic probity, nevertheless, it increased a flow of money both within and to the United States, which helped to make the Americans able to finance their commitments in terms of defense, but also in terms of consumerism, and thus to many senses assuage what might otherwise have been domestic discontent. So in short, the collapse of the Soviet bloc in 1989-1991 meant that whatever the American policy drawbacks of the 1980s, these drawbacks had not been such as to end the possibility of America achieving success in its competition with the Soviet Union. Now, let's just pause there for a second. We're going to be pausing at the end of the 1980s. We're going to discuss things with Graham in a second, because next time we're going to move on to the 1990s. But let's just pause and think for a second. What we've argued is that there are a plethora of factors in the international relations of the 80s, if you wish to call them the geopolitics of the 80s, each of which can be seen as being of great significance to what happened. Not that people necessarily appreciated that there would be such a cause and effect. We can start, as we've already done, by arguing that the resolution of the Vietnam War, again, the focus here is on East Asia, with the new alignment with China, meant first that the United States would not face heavy costs in preventing the Vietnam failure escalating in order to have defensive commitments in the Philippines, in Indonesia, towards Australasia, towards Thailand, Malaysia, wherever, and instead of which that the Americans had in practice been able to cut the costs, the real cost of their defense. So we could argue that. We could argue that this ensured that in the latter stages of the Cold War, the Americans succeeded at a cost in both politics and finance and military commitment below what otherwise might have been the case. Now, you can actualize that and say, well, hey, that's geography. In a sense, that's a Eurasian division, one in which China can be somehow seen because China centers on its power on and near the Pacific littoral, with the key cities being Shanghai, Guangzhou, Beijing, and most of the affluent population and industrial activity being in East China. You can say, hey, this is an example of the periphery or the rimland, to use Spikeman's vocabulary, and that is now cooperating with an out-of-area power, to wit the United States, which has bases in the area like Okinawa and Guam, in order to offset the heartland power of the Soviet Union. And you can say all of that, or you can say, well, that actually isn't the key point. The key point isn't geographical. The key point is a struggle for primacy within the Soviet bloc, a struggle that had really started as soon as Mao became leader in China in 1949, that there'd been tensions and resentments towards the Soviet Union in the last years of Stalin, including the Soviets going on holding bases within China, that after Stalin dies in 53, Mao is furious with the Khrushchev rejection of Stalinism, and that in a way, communism is split irrespective of its geography. After all, it's not geography that helps to explain why, from a different ideological position and differing positions, Yugoslavia and Albania do not follow the same route as the Soviet Union. And in fact, Albania aligns with China, which is a little difficult to explain in some kind of geography as destiny approach. So we've got to focus a bit on the development of the China situation. We have to focus a bit on the financial position and the way the financial position is not set in some immutable fashion. Here be oil, and this means A or B or C, because actually the use of oil, including the refinery capacity, shipment capacity, whether by oil tankers or by pipelines, use of it, etc., are not simply dominated by geopolitical considerations. So if you think of Angola, there were major oil reserves in the Cabinda enclave of northern Angola. Those were worked by an American oil company, which in turn financed a left-wing guerrilla movement as protection money, because it needed to be able to move the oil, but looked at differently. So too was there a shared interest by the left-wing guerrilla movement. Incidentally, you know, that's not too different. It's a horrible thing to have to say, but that's not too different from the shared interest of both Africans and non-Africans in exploiting enslavement in terms of then making money for Africa through selling goods into international markets. Now, what we have got is a multiplicity of factors which we need to think about in the 1980s. And we're not even looking at the argument that the Soviet Union proved unable to move from its heavy engineering economy to an electronic economy, and therefore couldn't match the Americans, in part because of the nature of its society, in part because of the inefficiencies of state-run enterprises, etc., etc. But what we do have is a question mark against the classic prominent salience of crude geopolitics. Graham.
Well, thank you very much, Jeremy. I mean, we're moving here into many different moving parts, not just the some of the issues we've been talking about in previous episodes of the nature of geography, in which regions to focus on in terms of priorities for the main powers, but also the ability of transport and weaponry and its reach. We're moving into also the influence that revenue and resources have. One aspect which I think is interesting, you touched on the ability of the bond market to open up to finance American spending without huge inflation. And you touched on the oil resources of the Middle East. Of course, the Soviet Union in this period, as well as its heavy engineering and its grain and so on, is also a major oil and gas producer. And a big event happens between 1984-85, which is when the international price of oil collapses. I wonder to what extent that was foreseen among strategists on the effect it would have on the Soviet economy to finance Soviet power at home and abroad.
Well, quite clearly, the Soviet Union as an oil economy was going to be hit by that, and also as a gas economy. But I think it's fair to say that the financial side tended not to attract as much attention as the military side from the point of view of those you might call strategists. There was much more interest in the agenda of missile distribution. There was much more concern about the actual intentions of Soviet leaders. And as you will recall, there are three rapid changes in 1982-1985. And one of them, when Andropov goes to the fore, becomes head, causes particular alarm. And there is a sense of uncertainty among outside commentators as to what is actually happening in the Soviet Union and what the intentions are. So you get episodes like the shooting down of the South Korean airliner, and people try and read the runes. Is this a deliberate step? Is it not a deliberate step? You know, how far does Soviet policy in Nicaragua or Cuban policy in Grenada reflect some master plan, or how far is this ad hoc? And I think one would have been better advised to emphasize the latter rather than to see some clear balance of strength, which could be weakened by particular steps. And, you know, as we know, Gorbachev's intention was not to end communism. And indeed, I think it's fair to say that unintended consequences are very significant in the 1980s and need to be considered and assessed accordingly. Now, you might say, I deliberately began with Jimmy Carter in order to emphasize that we should not put so much of an emphasis on Ronald Reagan, just as there's considerable continuity in foreign policy and military commitments between James Callaghan, scarcely a footite Marxist, and Margaret Thatcher. You know, one's got to be very cautious in and considerable continuity in that respect between Giscard d'Estaing and Mitterrand, where there was a change in 81. So one's got to be, and indeed between Helmut Schmidt and Helmut Kohl, one's got to be cautious in trying to work out where to put the focus. And because of that, one has to be aware that contemporaries who tried to argue for a structural situation, now you referred to the bond markets, I've been referring to the bond markets, and you know, Niall Ferguson makes brilliant use of the bond markets, but an equation move in pricing, price points between A and B, does not necessarily cause the perception of power to move as dramatically as one might envisage. And there's a useful thing to point to consider here. Douglas Johnson, the great expert on, now dead, on French 20th century politics and policy, once argued that Paul Kennedy's rise and fall of the great powers was deeply flawed because he'd left out 20th century France. And although France didn't clearly have the economic strength, nevertheless, because it acted and thought itself as a great power, particularly from de Gaulle onwards, therefore it should in effect be considered as a great power.
And I'm glad you've raised the subject of Paul Kennedy, because...
nice man, incidentally.
Yes, I mean... I
think his book is flawed. I wrote an entire book years ago on the great powers, which in a sense was a critique of Paul's book.
Yes, to what extent, though, did... I want to bring him into this discussion of geopolitical thinkers of the time, and to what extent they... even attempted to master different fields. So you know, the emphasis on military hardware and reach, the emphasis on economic resources, the emphasis on the shifting importance of different regions in the world. I mean, what one can attempt to be an expert in one of these, but with great difficulty in all of these. And I wonder, particularly for governments, particularly for Washington DC. During this period, to what extent either the State Department becomes the grand central station through which these different areas of focus are meshed and some kind of sense is made of them, or whether actually it's a mistake to think that either the State Department or any other institution of state really has the capacity or ability to process these conflicting priorities?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. First of all, I don't think the State Department under Ronald Reagan was the centre of policymaking in American strategic assessment. Obviously, in the 1970s and 80s as a whole, the State Department had vied, competed sometimes with the National Security Advisor. And I think it's fair to say that the Reagan court, and I'm not using that in a disparaging term, was one in which the Secretary of State for was often slightly tangential and not necessarily more influential than the Secretary for Defense, whilst there were other foreign policy views being advanced, for example, by the ambassador to the United Nations, etc., let alone Mrs. Thatcher on the phone. So I think, and of course, Reagan had his own views and he wasn't a fool. So I think one has to be very wary of assuming that there's some, you know, Weltpolitik being dictated either from state or from defense.
Mm-hmm. For defense, the priority for those of us in Britain at the time seemed to be, perhaps unsurprisingly, in Europe itself, the deployment of the SS-20s and the deployment of cruise Tomahawk weapons and Pershing weapons in Germany, in West Germany. Was that the perception in Washington that Europe was still the primary theatre and that East Asia could be considered less of a theatre because of the breakdown in relations between China and Russia during this period? You mentioned also Africa. Where does that fit in the range of top to bottom priority?
Well, prioritization is always the key element. And I think it's fair to say that there was divisions of opinion. And there were, if you wish to use the term, constituencies. As you know, the development of Central Command and the concern about the Middle East and, after all, the biggest war in the world in the 1980s was the Iran-Iraq War from 1980 to 1988, which concerned Americans anxious about either of them doing well and anxious about maintaining the security of shipping routes through the Gulf, not least because of oil flows. I mean, you know, from that point of view, if you were worried about that, or if you were worried about what was going to happen as a result of the 1982 conflict between Israel and Syria and the movement of American troops and other troops into Lebanon, you weren't necessarily going to put top of your agenda the inner German border. So I think one's got to be very careful. There is a tendency in European commentators to always imagine Europe comes first. And there is a very, I think, misleading, rather foolish tendency in a lot of geopolitical writing. One can see with that, for example, with Brendan Sims's work, to fail to assess the importance of the varied compositions of what you might regard as Asian geopolitics. And no, I would not put Europe at the forefront, and I would say those who do so are heavily mistaken.
Mm-hmm. Well, a final question, if I may, which is just to look at it from Moscow's perspective. Following Brezhnev's death, we have this period of relative instability with Russian leaders coming and going, Andropov, Chernyenko, and then we finally get to Gorbachev. But is there a feeling that the Russian geopolitical objectives are at their full stretch, and it's more a matter of keeping a hold of what they already have? Or were there still expansionist dreams in the Kremlin during this period?
Well, there were opportunities, and some opportunities appeared to go better than others. After all, if you've mentioned Africa, both in the Horn of Africa and the Mengistu regime in Ethiopia, both in the consequences of the fall of the Portuguese Empire with Angola and Mozambique, and then with the strains affecting the apartheid regime and the white majority regimes in Zimbabwe, Namibia, and South Africa, all those represented opportunities. Latin America, if anything, appears to represent maybe more of an opportunity in the 80s than it had done hitherto. So I wouldn't say that those were finished, but obviously, in the case of the Soviet Union, again, there are a whole range of constituencies to think about. So, you know, most people looking at it today tend to think in terms of the land and missile approach, which is fine. But it's worth bearing in mind that Soviet navalism is rising to a high point in the 80s, with Typhoon class nuclear submarines, with the attempt to move towards naval air power, and with the what appears to be a determination to project Soviet power into, in large quantities, the Atlantic and maybe further afield. So I don't think one wants to envisage the Soviet Union, again, as having one master plan. I think that's often, shall we say, an ex post facto rationalization of what is generally a more inchoate and flexible situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a resounding point to leave it on. We will pick up again in the next episode. Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. And readers might like to read, as I've mentioned already, my Cold War book, which does try and look in detail at how the Cold War in Europe ended.